very much. We're reading the book of Nahum, and if you can find that, we'll make a start together. Now, last evening, when we were together, I spent most of the time indicating why it was so important that the Bible would treat seriously the history and the future of the nation of Assyria. And we spent time looking back and seeing what they had been and how they'd been used by God as a rod of chastisement for the nation of Israel when it went astray. And I indicated to you that equally we learn in the future they're going to have a similar role. And we did notice too, strangely, that in the days when the Lord will reign supreme, in the great millennium 1,000-year reign, there will be three nations. It will be the nations that others will look to. Clearly there will be Israel, but there will also be Egypt and Assyria. So we realise how important that nation is. But we're going to be looking this evening at how God chastised them because they overstepped the mark. And we learned from Isaiah 10, didn't we, that they did overstep the mark and they did what they should not do. And we're going to read something of just what would happen. Now when the first chapter that we did look at very briefly last time, in it there is the decree. It is decreed that God will punish the city of Nineveh. So that we've looked at. I know I didn't cover every verse with you, but hopefully you have the gist of it. The two chapters before us, chapter 2 and 3, in chapter 2 you find that the great punishment is described, just how it will happen. And then in chapter 3, we learn why they deserve to be treated in the way that they were treated. Now I'm going to read I'll read chapter 2 with you and read a verse or 2 at the beginning of chapter 3, and then we'll look together at the passages. Nahum and chapter 2. He that dasheth in pieces is come before thy face. Keep the musician. Watch the way. Make thy loins strong. Fortify thy power mightily. For the Lord hath turned away the excellency of Jacob. Now that phrase, I'll pause and say to you, when it says turned it, it really means he's re-turned it. He's brought it again. So it really means this in modern day English. For the Lord hath brought again the excellency of Jacob as the excellency of Israel. For the emptiers have emptied them out and marred their vine branches. The shield of his mighty men is made red, the valiant men in scarlet. The chariot shall be with flaming torches in the day of his preparation. And the fig tree shall be terribly shaken. The chariot shall rage in the streets. They shall jostle one another in the broadways. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like lightnings. He shall recount his worthies. They shall stumble in their walk. They shall make haste to the wall thereof, and the defense shall be prepared. And the gates of the river shall be opened, and the palace shall be dissolved. And Husab shall be led away captive. She shall be brought up, and with her maids shall lead her, as with the voice of doves, tapering. That word just means drumming or beating, drumming upon their breasts. But Nineveh is of old like a pool of water. Yet they shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry, but none shall look back. Take ye the spoil of silver, take the spoil of gold, for there is none end of the store and glory out of all the pleasant furniture. She is empty and void and waste, and the heart melteth, and the knees smite together, and much pain is in all loins, and the faces of them are all gather blackness. Where is the dwelling of the lions, and the feeding place of the young lions? Where is the lion, even the old lion walked, and the lion's whelp, and none made them afraid? The lion that tear in pieces enough for his whelps, and strangled for his lionesses, and filled his holes with prey and dens with ravin. Behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will burn her chariots in the smoke, and the sword shall devour thy young lions, and I will cut off thy prey from the earth, and the voice of thy messengers shall no more be heard. Woe to the bloody city, It is full of lies and robbery. The prey departeth. The noise of the whip and the noise of the rattling of the wheels and of the prancing horses and the jumping chariots. The horsemen lifted up both the bright sword and the glittering spear. And there is a multitude of slain and of a number of carcasses. And there is none end of the corpses, and they stumble upon their corpses because of the multitude of the whoredoms of the well-favoured harlot, the mistress of witchcrafts that selleth nations through her whoredoms, the families through her witchcrafts. And the story goes on to tell a little more of why it was they deserved the punishment they faced. It's a remarkable little book, isn't it, the Book of Nahum? Not just because it deals with the story of how God punished that great nation of Assyria, or in particular that great city of Nineveh. It's a very remarkable story. And yet, you know, strangely, in the lectionaries, you know, these are the books that we have where there are set services, and bits of the Bible are chosen. And among the Jews, they have those kind of things that you would get in some of the churches, like the Church of England in our land, a book of the selected readings that would be chosen, and people would read from them in a very formal way. The Jews are the same. And one thing you'll not find in any of their lectionaries, as they're called, you'll not find any mention of the Book of Nahum. How strange. How very strange. I remember reading about it, and the man who was objecting that for all these centuries they've utterly ignored the Book of Nahum, he said this: it really means they think that there is nothing theological, nothing about God in the book, and nothing ethical, nothing about right and wrong. But he's absolutely right, isn't he? For we read at the beginning of chapter 1 a great description of the great God of heaven, set out in clause after clause after clause of the kind of God he is. For that reason, the man's right. It should have been among the books. But where we are this evening is going to tell us that there are ethical reasons, reasons of right and wrong in the book. There's no doubt about that. Because when we started the book, we learned, didn't we, that the reason that Assyria and Nineveh were allowed to do what they did was simply because Israel sinned grievously against God. And you remember I mentioned that it happened at the time when the nation had split into two. 10 of the tribes in the north and 2 of the tribes in the south. And so grievous were the sins of this tribe in the north that this great nation was allowed to carry the whole lot, or at least 290,000 of them, into captivity. There's no doubt sin is dealt with in the book. And we're coming to a passage that tells you that God looked upon the rod that was going far beyond what was asked of it. And God punishes it. So we can have absolutely no doubt that the man's objections were right. There's a lot that's theological about our God. And a lot that's ethical about right and wrong in this great book that we have before us. Now, I'm not a Hebrew scholar. There'll be plenty of them, but I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I do know that they all agree that our chapter 2, each of the chapters is an ode, is a poem. You remember I told you that the ode means a poem about a specific topic, and usually it takes all the irregularities of the topic and it reflects itself in the poetry. But the 3 poems are masterly, but the one that's seen as really at the top of the pile is our 2nd chapter. And in it, those who would know better than I would know, and we can catch it even in our English translation, the lines are all short, because it's a battle that's on. And the lines are all moving speedily, because you don't leisurely go about a battle. You're in the thick of things, and you have to move quickly. And you're not going to make great long orations in the middle of a battle. Civil orders are what a person would have to do. And our 2 chapters, 2 and 3, reflect that, but particularly our chapter 2. The other thing about chapter 2 that we have to bear in mind too is that it's full of technical phrases that were borrowed from other languages. And the translators have a lot of trouble with it for that reason. Had you lived at the time of Nahum, when there was much international activity on the war front, you would have known about a lot of these terms, but as the centuries have passed, well, people just don't have the same access. So the translators always find particularly chapter 2 difficult. And you would realise that also means the folks like you and me who try to interpret it don't find it particularly easy either. So the phrases here and there that you and I would struggle with, and certainly everyone who writes about it struggles with the same struggles. So we're going to look at chapter 2 in particular, and then a bit of chapter 3. We're going to look at what we saw there. We're going to see how it described just what happened when this great city of Nineveh fell. Now let me say to you that this city was undoubtedly the greatest city the world had ever seen up until this point. It had the largest population that had come into it from all sorts of places and had grown to a size of 300,000, which in their day was really a mega city. They'd never seen anything like it. It was one that stood out as utterly supreme. It had the finest palace that the world had ever known. It's sometimes called the palace without equal because of its beauty and because this wealthiest of all cities up until this point in time lavished on it. In it, it had the greatest library the world had ever seen. It had never seen a proper library until this city came to the fore. Indeed, it's said, but I think there's maybe not a lot of historical backup for the claim, that Alexander the Great, when he founded what became the greatest library of his day, he had sight of what was in Nineveh, but I think there's a big question mark about whether that was so. But he would know about it. And for you and I, for an interest to you and me, in that library were two accounts of the Noahic flood, the flood of Noah's day. We had two long books about Noah's flood. It had also around it the first botanical garden the world had ever seen, and the first zoological garden, zoo, that the world had ever known. And it was a city that was protected. It had the largest protected space that the world had ever known. There's the mighty Tigris down one side of it, a huge river, one of the world's great rivers, not one for paddling in, huge river. And it had another river, the Kosher, that came and met it just outside the walls of Nineveh. And from it, and from its tributaries, they had built a protected space that was surrounded by water, with great moats that were not only deep, but moats that were 150 feet broad. Think of it. 150 feet broad. Surrounded them. They had walls that were 50 feet high. Except near the gates where they were 100 feet high. This was a tremendous city. Even where it was placed geographically, it had a lot of cover from hills. And this is the city that God was going to bring to nothing. Our chapter tells the story of how that great city fell, never to be built again. Not many years afterwards, very few people could remember exactly where it had been. I mentioned Alexander the Great. He'd been at battle very near it, I think it would be a couple of hundred years after this. And he made a detour, and there was not a sight of the city of Nineveh. And it lay undisturbed and unknown under a mound of earth, a huge mound of earth, until 1842. Now, even the oldest here weren't around in 1842, but it's a long time from 612 BC to 1842. 2,500 years it had lain. And that's why they know so much about it, because a strange Englishman by the name of Layard and a Frenchman by the name of Botha, they set about its excavation. And they learned that the walls I've been telling you about were broad enough for three chariots to move at speed, three abreast along the wall. What a width it must have been. The streets were wide. It was protected in all the ways I've been telling you. And God brought it to naught. And that's what we're really looking at as we read our chapter. Now, I'm telling you the story of it because I think it helps us to interpret some of the things we're going to see. So look with me at our chapter and let me divide it just into some sections for you. If you notice the verses 1 and 2, they go together. And I'm going to describe it like this. Sound the alarm, is what's been said. You need to be ready to face the foe. Sound the alarm. It's Nahum taunting the folks that are inside the walls and the gates. Sound the alarm, says verses 1 and 2. Verses 3 and 7 say, save the king and queen. We'll meet the queen. We'll have trouble finding the king. We'll talk about that in a minute. But then verses 8 to 10, you'll notice the plunderers come in. And I suppose the instruction in this thing is, sack the kingdom, steal what you want to steal. And then in verses 11 down to 15, we find that there's a search of the lion's den, where the place most protected of all the very protected places, where the king and his main generals would do the plotting and planning. So that's the outline of our chapter. And just for a little, we'll look at that. You notice it begins by announcing that right at the gate, face to face with them, is he that dasheth in pieces. Probably that could mean that there's people who've come with the great war axes and they're going to try to fell down the wooden gates. It may be that, but many of the scholars think it just means that the great forces of the conspiracy against Nineveh are going to be at the gate. Who will it be? Well, they'll be mainly the Medes, what we would now call part of Persia. The Medes, the Babylonians, who at this time were nothing like as important as the Assyrians were and the city of Nineveh was. And then the Scythians, who were just from north of the Black Sea in what's now Russia. These were the kind of people that had come together in order that they might attack. There's this great city of Nineveh. They did not know it, but they were doing what God was intending to happen. It was really the will of God that they be there. That God was judging this great city. That God was going to bring it down. And you notice that our writer taunts them again, and he says, keep the munition. Now, because of the translation, that doesn't read very well. But if I tell you that word, munitions, it would be a word that we would use. You know how we've got a word for castles, a keep. So really what he said is, keep the keeps. And of course we would might say, fortify the fortresses. It's alliterated. And he's saying this to them, you'll need all that you've got, and you'll need to build it stronger. Then he says, watch in the way, for this is going to be difficult for you. The enemy will come at you from all directions. And you'll need courage. Make thy loins strong. And then he says again, fortify thy power mightily. You say, but why? And we're given the most amazing of explanations in that second verse. For the Lord has brought again the excellency of Jacob, the excellency of Israel. For centuries, God had let people like the Assyrians deal with his people and with their little land that we call the land of Israel. They seemed to be able to do what they liked. But God says, enough. They suffered enough. And that's the end. And he's going to restore to favor, going to bring again the glory of Israel. Going to raise them. It comes that word excellency. Comes from the rising from away down to high up. He's going to raise them to a position of eminence. He's going to take them back into favor. That's the reason that this great city of Nineveh is going to be brought down. Never to rise again. And from 612 or so, right until where we are today, it has never risen. Right across the water from the city of Mosul that's there in Iraq to this very day. Yes, that's what happened. God came in again. And of course, it's a story that's a long way to run before Israel realise they're coming back into favour. But that's not the story of Nahum. His story is how God brought down the one that would be used so devastatingly against them, this great city of Nineveh. Well, what has she done to them? Well, she's emptied them out and marred their vine branches. She said, well, that's a very strange combination. That word emptied, it's a whole lot of words used in your Old Testament for emptied, is a word that you would use for depopulating. You've reduced the population. I told you about the thousands that were taken into captivity. Word of drop in population in the little land of Israel all of a sudden. Very few left. The emptiers have emptied them out. And they've marred the vine branches. Now I don't need to tell you that one of the figures of Israel as a nation is the vine, and their land the vineyard. A contemporary of this man Nahum, a man whose name you would know better, Isaiah, he wrote a parable of the vineyard, and you read it in chapter 5. And in it, at the end of it, he tells you that the people of Judah, they are the vine, and the land of Israel is the vineyard. Well, these people had marred that vineyard. They had broken the branches of that vine. They reduced it to nothing and to uselessness. And even though Judah was left more or less intact, they had ruined it to a large extent. But God says, that day is nearly over. And you're going to face my army. And he tells you who they are as we begin to move into the second section. Save the king and the queen. We're introduced to his army. And the strange thing is that they're dressed in scarlet. And they're mighty men, and they're red in colour. And they're people who come with chariots and so on. And you say, who can they be? Well, if you'd been living at the time when this man was writing, you might have struggled maybe to know. But as time went on, you would soon know. Because the Medes were the people who always fought in red garments. They're not the only one, but they were one of the main ones. And they're really the lead body that's in this great conspiracy against Nineveh. But God says that they're his mighty men, the shield of his mighty men. That is God's mighty men. These are the men that are there. Not just the shields too are red. Because one of the things that the Persians did was if it was a plain shield, they painted it red to make it look as if it was blood that was on it, so that you would say, well, these are mighty warriors. Look at the blood stains on the shield. But they also use a lot of copper shields, which in the light of the sun, people tell me, could perhaps look as if it was red. But certainly, in the poetic language of where we get, these are seen to be important. And we're told, too, that well, these are not the only things that mark them. But they've got chariots, and the idea of the flaming torches doesn't just mean they use them at night. It means that they move with such speed. Whereas the sun glistened in the meeting during the day, you'd have thought it was a torch that was fleeing along the wall. And they would have armors, they would have weapons with them too, among them. They would be spears, and they would be made out of, it says, fir trees. And the word's a bit more specific in the Hebrews, it's cypress trees, and they make, I'm told, very strong weapons, and that's what it is that they're with. But you don't only notice that. You're asked to note, too, in verse number 4, a rage. That's a word that comes from the same word as madness. And it's because these chariots are moving at such a pace that you're saying these men are mad. Look at them. Do they not realise the danger they're in? Never mind what they'll do to others as they jostle against each other in the broad streets that they've entered. And remember, this is a vision this man's seeing of something that was only going to happen a number of years ahead. And he's describing it in absolutely detail. Yes, said he, and even those that are underfoot, it will run like lightnings. So you get the picture, don't you, of what this battle seems about and the devastation it's going to bring. Now you say, but where are they finding this king? Well, if we're going to find him in our section at all, it's in that word that begins verse 5. He shall recount his heroes, the men who've covered themselves with glory in previous battles. He's going to recount in the sense of instruct them what's expected of them in this great hour of crisis. And if that's not where he is, then worse still, he isn't there at all. For you don't read about him. As you read through, you read it with me, you don't read about him. But my own view is that he does occur there. And his queen is that woman that is named for you in verse 7, Husab. She's there. You'd have known she was a woman of some worth. I doubt if any of the dear sisters that are here this evening have maids that go with them from place to place. Most of you haven't. You might have a manservant, but no maids. Well, she has. So the king is there, I think. He's the one you read of as key. And some of the modern translations actually put in the word their king. So a lot of them would stand where I stand. But there are others who think that really what's described in that, who's described in that word, he is some of the generals outside trying to get into this mighty city. But I take the view that this is the king, and he realizes what's happening. But move then from he to they, and we meet people who are at the wall, and we read about the defense. That word is really the word that's used for the kind of defense anybody attacking a wall would have over them against stones being dropped on them or weapons being thrown at them as they try to pound the wall on the way in. I take it the king has said, we need to do something about these people that have brought the battering rams to my walls. We need to do something about them. And these people that are there, they're obviously a hard job. The people who are working with the battering rams, so they stumble as they move forward to try to bring the wall down. And they've got this defensive, the mantelet, as it's called, protecting them. And here they begin to learn that they thought very carefully about how they'll bring down this great city. Its defences are walls and water. And they need to be able to deal with the water. I reminded you last time about how Babylon was brought down. What happened there was they diverted the water away from Babylon and they went in the empty riverbed and took the city on the night that King Belshazzar died. But I said to you last week, what happens this time is that water that should be flowing somewhere else is made to come into the city. And that's why we begin to read about the gates of the city being opened. Not the gates that you would walk in, but the gates of the river. The gates of the river are to be opened, verse number 6. And this came, the timing was right. These men that were involved in this battle had thought about it. But we know under the hand of God, they didn't realize that he was moving them in particular directions. But there had been an extremely heavy spring rain. And the water levels, not on the Tigris, but on the Kosher, had become dangerously high. And what happened was, it became so forceful that whether with human intervention or just because of the sheer weight of water, it was that pounded into the city, much of which was built of mud, even the very palace, and it smashed the city to smithereens. God was in it. They were his army. They were doing his bidding as they brought this great city to nothing. We hear no more of the king, but we meet the woman who was at his elbow, and she's brought up, and her maids leave her, and they're mourning, they've got their mournful cries like the voice of a dove, and they're beating on their breasts. Alas, alas, Nineveh certainly is falling. But then I said to you, there's a bit about the sacking of the city, stealing its treasures. And the water has been so important And now our writer, you can see the irony he uses all the way. He says, now let me tell you a bit about water in a cistern. Well, it's there and you need it. And he tells them, of course, in the next chapter, as he taunts them again about the siege, that they should have had plenty of water for the siege. But he says, you know, this pool of water, this water that's in the cistern, that's what Nineveh's been like. It's brought in all the commerce of the nations, and everybody's there in great numbers, and they're so strong in themselves that they can face anything. But you know what happens if you put a hole in a cistern? The water ebbs away. And he's now going to draw their attention to one of the real weaknesses of Nineveh. And their 300,000 of a population, it had grown from very little in a very short time. And there were people from every nation that they had conquered, from every city they had taken. They were just a great mass of people. They had no allegiance to anybody in anything except making money, getting its rank. That was all they cared about. There wasn't a beat of patriotism in their breasts. And when Nineveh was pierced, they fled out where they could get out. Like water out of a cistern. So you can see how he uses water when telling the story of the battle. And he moves it to talking about the people. And he says, the king's crying, stand, stand. And note the people who are running don't turn back. Either to listen or to do anything. Because really they have no allegiance to that great city. But Zephaniah tells the story. He tells, I think it's in chapter 3. And the first word that I'll use is emphatic in the original. I am. And it's Nineveh speaking. And there is none like me. But you know, there was no single I. There was no persona that was really Nineveh. There were a multitude of people. And in the day of crisis, nobody would stand. And they just fled in all directions. Yes, none looked back. And it meant that the people who were coming in, yes, they would slay many who were eating great numbers of carcasses, but they come, says verse number 9, to take the spoil. And there's no end to it. No matter how much they take, there's still more there. But this is the wealthiest city the world has ever known. And there's nobody to withstand them. They take fancy furniture, which was not common in that kind of day. And they leave it, to notice verse number 10, empty, void, waste. And these words are fairly similar in meaning, and I won't stop to describe them. But we're told what the people who were fleeing were like. Their heart was melted, their knees were smiting. The gnawing and the pain in their loins was great, their faces were black with fear. And you say, but what about the mighty men? What about the men who were charging the city? And that's where we read out the section that I've described. Search for lion's den. And you notice, and I'm not sure if I know another passage in your Bible like this. You find the whelps there. You find the young lions there. You find the lions there. You find the old lions there. And you find the lionesses there. Now if you could tell me another passage like that, tell me before I leave. I'd like to write it down. How remarkable. The young whelps are those who are not old enough to feed, or to hunt. The young lions, the word comes from the word for cover, because the mane has started to grow to cover that part of their body. So they're there, they're able to go and hunt. And the lion and the old lion are able to hunt. And the lionesses is obviously some are suckling some of these cubs. And they're there. And the one I should have mentioned, the word for whelps is the word for abiding at home. Because they weren't old enough to leave the lair. And Mama was with them. She was caring for them. And there was somebody feeding her. So the five groups of them are there. Everyone being what you would expect to find there. But when they get to the lion's den, it's very clear. It's as empty as the city. None of them have stood the test. They've all fled. The most brazen of them is the woman Huzzah. How very, very sad the fall of that great city. And I have two or three more minutes. I think I've dealt with most of the story of chapter 2 for you. But let me take you in very briefly to why it was that God dealt with them as he did. And it starts with this blood-curdling woe. Woe to the bloody city. And we're told some of the things that it's guilty of. Here are some of them. It's full of lies and robbery. That is, when they struck a treaty with a nation, nobody could really, in their heart of hearts, believe that Nineveh would stand by. It's too powerful. So they signed up for treaties of all sorts and kinds, and it just swept them aside when it suited them. They were liars through and through. They were robberies in the sense that they annexed great portions of land, anything that was valuable to them, for whatever reason, and to reward whomever. They just took these things from the people that they conquered. They were guilty of that. Yes, they were these things that meant nothing to them. They were always after prey, and they were always determined to gain. And we read about some of the things that they had, plenty of gold, plenty of stores of furniture and so on. All of these things were theirs. But we also read that they had a bewitching effect on both nations and families. And that last verse that we read together, verse 4. Nations and families. Because they were the world's leading authority in all kinds of witchcraft and idolatry. Whenever they raided any place, they took the gold. They had 34 huge temples to various gods, more than one in some of them. And that had a bewitching effect, I say again, on both nations and families. I must admit, when I was reading that, and I read it many times, thank you this weekend, nations and families. And you know, in every nation there are those who are influential, or great politicians, or queens. The people who are high in medical authorities, or in education, and many of these kind of bodies that affect everybody, they can influence nations. And there are other people who influence families, and not always for good. One of the worrying things about people who rule is that things that they think are about what they're doing to nations, when it comes down to the level of a family, is a disaster. And unless Whitburn is amazingly different from any other place I know in the universe, it's so here. You'll have your multitudes of broken homes, of drug addicts, and I won't keep lengthening the list. Much of it because of decisions that are made at a political level that might seem all right. And it's the kind of things that other nations are doing. But when it comes down to the level of the family, it's absolutely disastrous. This nation we're thinking about, this great city that we're reading of, was exactly one of them. Big effect on nations. Moving in the direction of idolatry. A big effect on families. Demanding things that came to affect family life. And you think of those people who were transported from the northern part of Israel into this land and finding themselves confronted with all the practices of heathendom. Yes, they affected both nations and families. And it is for that reason that there was so much bloodshed, so many corpses, and the end of a city that had no match in the world at that time and had never had one like it. And it fell never to rise again because of the way it lived, the way it behaved. And although I started by saying to you that the man who was lamenting the fact that Nahum wasn't one of those lectionaries, he's absolutely right. Our book, our little book of Nahum, is a clear indication of what right and wrong mean when it comes to the experience of nations, but you and I would also know to the experience of families and individuals. Trust the Lord will bless you what we've been thinking of together.